Good afternoon. My name is Sharon, and I serve the village's education coordinator, and I feel like I'm a flight attendant that needs to make sure you're in the right spot because we switch. So if you came on the bus today and you're supposed to be in orientation, that's next door. But today, I'm pleased to introduce Richard Gorling and present his first session on mindfulness and policing, leading change, healing suffering, and building community. Today, tomorrow, and Friday. So thank you, Richard, very much.
So good afternoon. This is not the first time I've given a talk in bare feet. So I figured, you know, I'm in the woods. I was just down at the creek a little while ago, and it got a little bit wet, and there was a deep hole I found, which would have swallowed me up, and I was super tempted just to sort of slide in the water, and but I didn't think I'd be able to come back here entirely wet. I chose not to do that. Instead, just got a little bit wet. We're going to talk about policing and mindfulness and police reform and community and a lot of interesting things today. The first thing I'll tell you is that my approach to this is controversial in different places, okay? And in many ways, when I talk about mindfulness and policing and I talk about police reform, it is in fact an assault on popular culture and policing, and it's intended to be. It is, however, not an assault on authentic culture. And as we move from this notion of popular culture, how is policing defined in America today, to how ought it be defined? Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I know exactly how it ought to be defined, that I know exactly what authentic police culture looks like in a democracy in the 21st century, but I do know that it looks different than what it looks like today. And I do understand some of the forces acting upon policing in America today. And I think that my experience, my story, if you will, has some relevance for all of us. And my hope is not that you agree with me, because trust me, I'm no stranger to controversy. My hope is that rather than agree with me, that this sparks some dialogue, that sparks some curiosity in how you look at policing in America, and in whatever ways you engage in your community, offers you just some opportunities to see things differently, and perhaps step into that conversation where otherwise you might not have. So let me talk about mindfulness, right? How many of you heard the term mindfulness, right? Of course you have. Yeah, you can't go into 7-Eleven without seeing a magazine with some promise about how mindfulness is going to save your life, right? And you can have that Slurpee and you can just do 5 minutes meditation and that sugar will not have an impact on your body, right? And I'm convinced that's not true. But this is sort of the promise, sort of the ubiquitous promise of mindfulness, is it some sort of panacea that's going to fix us. And clearly that's not true. But I do think that there's some science behind mindfulness that is really, really critical. And I want to share a really short video with you. Dan Harris talks about mindfulness. Dan Harris is a really interesting character. Anybody recognize the name ABC? He's a correspondent. So Dan is a news correspondent. He's on ABC. He sits, I think, on the weekend, Good Morning America. Maybe on the weekdays, he sits, ironically, at night on the desk. But he's written a number of books about mindfulness, and he's become quite the, as he frames it, the evangelist for mindfulness. But I'm probably going to get to volume. But let me share this short video with you so we get to the gritty reality of what mindfulness really is in the context that I'm talking about.
Hey, I'm Dan Harris. You may have heard this word mindfulness. It's become something of a buzz phrase of late. It's all over the place. The word itself is kind of boring and anodyne sounding, but it's actually a really rich word with lots of meanings. So I'm going to give you one simple, serviceable definition, which is this. Mindfulness is the ability to know what's happening in your head in any given moment without getting carried away by it. I'm going to say that again, because this is a game-changing proposition. Mindfulness is the ability to know what's happening in your mind right now without necessarily taking the bait and acting on it. Imagine how useful this would be. Just as an example, driving down the road and somebody cuts you off in traffic. How do you normally react? I think most of us, we normally react by having a thought, which is, I'm pissed. And then what happens next? You immediately, habitually, reflexively inhabit that thought. You actually become pissed. There's no buffer between the stimulus and your reaction. With mindfulness on board, with just a little bit of mindfulness, in that same situation, you might notice, oh, my chest is buzzing, my ears are turning red, I'm having a starburst of self-righteous thoughts, I'm getting angry. but you don't necessarily have to act on it and chase that person down the road screaming at them with your kids in the back of the car thinking you've done enough. Mm-hmm. Now, you might be thinking, don't I need to get angry somehow? Aren't I justified? I would say yes, but probably not as much as you think. The proposition here is not that you should be rendered by mindfulness into some lifeless, non-judgmental blob. The proposition is that you should learn how to respond wisely to things that happen to you, rather than just reacting blindly. And that, my friends, is a superpower. A superpower. How do you get it? I hesitate to tell you this, but the way to get it is through meditation, which I know some of you will think sounds irretrievably annoying. However, it's not. It's doable, even for you. And we have some other videos up on the site where you can learn how to do it. You should watch those videos immediately. However, before you do that, let me just tell you one thing. I believe that meditation and mindfulness are the next big public health revolution. In the 1940s, if you told somebody you were going running, they would have said, "Who's chasing me?" But then what happened next? The scientists looped in, they showed that physical exercise is really good for you, and now all of us do it, and if we don't, we feel guilty about it. And that's where I think we're headed with mindfulness and meditation. It's going to join the pantheon of no-brainers like brushing your teeth, eating well, and taking the meds your doctor prescribed for you. Again, these are all things that we do, and if we don't do, we feel guilty about it. Let me just close by saying, mindfulness is not going to solve all of your problems. It's not going to render your life a nonstop parade of unicorns and rainbows. There's a reason why, when I wrote a book about meditation, I called it 10% Happier. Nonetheless, this is a superpower, and one that is accessible by you immediately.
Okay. We'll come back to this tomorrow if you choose to join me, all three of you. And I want to talk more about that quote. So where are we going today? So I'll give you a little bit of background about me, how we got here, talk a little bit about what I refer to as a landscape of suffering, what's going on in policing in America today, as measured really from the lens of public health issue. I really do believe that policing in America is not only a socioeconomic issue, but it's a public health issue, okay? And that may make more sense as I give you some more data, okay? Because I am a nerd. There's a lot of data to look at. And I've spent the last 15 years looking at data and trying to figure out what to do about it. A little bit about what is mindfulness. Although the intention was to have three sessions, the first session was going to be just a mindfulness session. The second one was going to be more of this focus on policing. And the third, tomorrow, we'll still do this one, is really an inquiry. It's a community inquiry of what can we do? What can we all do together? And again, not looking for right or wrong answers, but just what can we do together to improve policing in America, and really what that means is what can we do together to support the men and women who choose to lace up their boots every day and go out into communities and do the very, very complex work of policing. Okay, so that's tomorrow. Before we get going any further, I just want to ask, how many of you have family members in the business of policing? How many, maybe retired coppers, any retired cops in here? Any current cops in here? Okay, it's always helpful to know, because I look out for those folks. They're the ones that want to come punch me in the throat. initially, eventually they become my friends, some of them. Trauma is a powerful, powerful force. Mm. So how did we get here? Yeah, I don't even know sometimes. So it's 2003. I just returned to my day job as a police sergeant in Hillsborough, Oregon. I say returned, I was gone for 2 years on active duty with the U.S. Coast Guard after 9/11. And I didn't go anywhere sexy, and I stayed stateside, did a lot of work with, really with standing up the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And I'll do my best to hold my tongue on criticism, but list a lot of that. However, I returned as a police sergeant, and I started paying attention just to policing in general, just a slightly different lens, a little more macro look at what was going on in the world. And it was clear to me that we needed better training. We needed better training to equip the men and women to encounter a citizen, okay? To have that police-citizen encounter when the variables are complex, they're often rapidly evolving, they're sometimes violent, but if not actually violent, they're surrounded by all kinds of human suffering and violence on the periphery. And how do we encounter that day after day, sometimes hour after hour during the course of an 8, 10, 12-hour watch? And one, how do we stay sane? Two, how do we hold on to our humanity? And how do we, maybe said differently, how do we not become cynical assholes? Okay, I can swear up here, it's Holden, right? I spent 27 years in the Coast Guard, most of those on the reserve side of the house, and you can't walk away from that community without really being very skillful at your language. So I'll do my best to be polite. You know, so how do we stay healthy? How do we hold on to our humanity? And then how do we really flesh out this mission that is policing, right? Which really essentially is building community, right? It's what we colloquially refer to as community policing, but nobody really knows what the hell that means. I mean, you literally can look within U.S. Department of Justice, which is the all-knowing U.S. DOJ, right? They know everything. And clearly, I mean, obviously, just pay attention to the news. There are multiple definitions of community policing. We can't even internally, inside our own house, we can't figure out what the hell it means, right? And so clearly, it's not gonna cascade down into the tactical application in your communities so that law enforcement really understands what it is. A lot of policing in America is political doublespeak. It just is, right? You go to your police leaders and you want answers, you're gonna get sort of the bullshit political doublespeak, okay? And you're gonna walk away, you heard what you wanted to hear, I said what I wanted to say, and we all can pretend everything's okay. Now, if we're white folks and we're middle class, that works wonderfully. But if we're people of color or otherwise marginalized, it doesn't help so much. Okay? So I'm a big systems critic. And what I teach law enforcement officers is how to exist in a system that is broken without the delusion that we're going to change the system. Without the delusion that we're going to change the system. I believe in the power of the individual to infect culture in positive ways and to do good in those micro moments of the world as we encounter others. But to think that we're going to teach mindfulness and change police culture is not only unrealistic, but it's probably not responsible. Maybe even diagnosably problematic. What I found was we needed something other than what we were doing, okay? I became a student of trauma, of stress, of human performance. And I dabbled a little bit in Dan Goleman's work on emotional intelligence. I even worked with some colleagues, and we put together a 3-day training, made it mandatory. It was really good training, but it was completely worthless. And basically taught them about Goleman's framework on emotional intelligence. Anybody here study emotional intelligence, maybe read some of Goleman's work? Really brilliant dude. I mean, really, it's awesome. You know, and I like to refer to Dan Goleman as Danny Goleman. I can say Danny did this and did that because it sounds like I know him well, but I don't. And even his work has evolved over time. And if we had more time, I'd show you a couple of things that he's put together around compassion. They're remarkable. Back to emotional intelligence. It wasn't enough to teach to the head. In other words, it wasn't enough to put cops in a room and say, hey, here's what empathy is, here's what compassion is, here's how to be attuned to others, here's how to be attuned to yourself. It was really interesting, right? But it wasn't helpful. And so what was missing between action and knowledge was something in the middle, and that is skills training. And so I became a student in particular of how do we train human performance? And I was still connected in the Coast Guard. I was a senior officer in the Coast Guard Reserve. I had some really interesting connections to the U.S. Department of Defense. Basically, different communities that are really interested in training elite performers. And what I found was that there was this quest to integrate mind-body practices into training. And so what do I mean? I mean things like we all think about yoga, right? Yes, yoga, meditation, other kinds of mind-body practices. And I explored this thing called meditation some more. And I talked to some military special operators who practiced meditation and were just like, wasn't a big deal with that. Like, yeah, whatever. Before we go out on this mission, I'm gonna spend, you know, several days in my own space practicing yoga and meditation. And maybe somebody with a faith background is gonna throw in centering prayer, you know, whatever it might look like, but they're really deeply diving in here. And so I realized that what was missing in the training for law enforcement was training to become more aware of what's going on here. Mm-hmm. Training to understand how trauma impacted us, okay? And there are known, I'm gonna strike out on this word, there are known significant negative effects, I'm not going to use that word, sorry, negative effects on our bodies as a result of trauma, okay? And law enforcement officers are exposed to trauma, not just operationally, but also administratively. Mm-hmm. And over time, it's predictable that we achieve a state of burnout. Okay, it's not unlike other professions, okay? But we're talking about policing here. We achieve this state of burnout. And we essentially do very little for our police officers to enhance their ability to stay well. If I had more whiteboards, I'd draw you some really cool charts, but I don't right now. Maybe tomorrow. I have one that kind of puts all that in perspective with just a simple XY chart. The bottom line is this. I took six police officers in it was probably 2005. And we got together after doing some yoga, right? And we said, okay, we're going to take this mindfulness-based stress reduction course. But we're not going to take it together because that's too weird. Right? So we each said, okay, over the course of 6 months, let's each go take this 8-week class from a local instructor, and then let's come back together and see how it goes. And so a couple months went by, I had not yet joined the class, and one of my detectives, a guy named Sean, calls me. It was really unusual, like, oh, that's interesting, he's calling me, okay? And he's just like, dude, he's like, I'm in week 5 of this class, man, something magical just happened, right? And this is a guy who is he's a badass police officer. He's currently serving as a detective. He's very skilled. He's also lived on I call it a commune. I mean, he's got a very eclectic upbringing, very eclectic life, very well-read, very smart, and kind of a renaissance man. He starts to describe some of the exercises they were doing in the NBSR course. Basically, it's just like, this is absolutely, really critically important for police officers. We need to push forward and train this. Okay, so I went through the course, and a couple other folks went through the course, and then I reconvened with each of them separately because, you know, it's too weird to get together and talk about meditation. And without exception, they all said, yeah, this is awesome. Let's figure out a way. It's a little weird, but let's figure out a way to make this happen. So I went to each of them and said, okay, you know, are you willing to work with me? Are you willing to kind of champion this with me? And they're all like, are you kidding? Really? You're asking me to actually do this? And I was like, yeah? And I'm like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. Good luck. We'll support you, which means not laugh as hard. And so I wrestled with this whole notion of bringing meditation to police officers. And ultimately, what I recognized was that sometimes your path chooses you.
Yeah.
And I would not have ever thought that I was going to be teaching mindfulness meditation to police officers. But it feels right, and it actually is proven to be the absolute correct thing for me to do. Yeah, there's not enough time for other fun stories. So we're going to move on. Here's something, there's some just fun data points up there. I'm not going to read all those because you all can read. But let's get to the notebooks that you all have. And if you don't have a notebook, they're over here. Please take one. Those notebooks are a tangible takeaway from this training. Okay? There's two things. One's the notebook, and then there's a sticker in there for Mindful Badge Initiative. That's my work, and you can do whatever you want with that sticker. Just don't put it on the walls anywhere around here in Holden. I'll be able to say that, right? My website is on there. Lots of resources there at mindfulbadge.com. But the idea with this notebook is that this is yours, okay? This is just my gift to you. And if nothing else, the invitation is to use this notebook to practice gratitude. I'm a big believer in our habits of thinking, said differently, mindset. Carol Dweck is a psychologist at Stanford. She's done a lot of research on this notion of mindset. And what is our mindset? And I think when we wake up in the morning, how we choose to enter that day, that gift, is critically important. And if we wake up and say, oh, man, I gotta deal with this stuff again, then our bodies will follow the intention of those words, right? Our emotions will follow the intentions of those words and what our body's doing. But if we wake up and offer the day some gratitude and say, man, I'm grateful to breathe. You know, puking my guts out a couple days ago, I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to vomit, right? I know it sounds silly. You know? But it's how we approach the world reframes not only what we're thinking, but literally our immune system responds, our body's response to the world around us. And so once a day, the invitation is to write something you're grateful for, specifically in that notebook, and make it useful. And then do whatever else you want with it. That's the intention behind that. There's a tremendous amount of research right now on compassion. And I think it's really important to talk about that. I have some resources. My wife Erica's over here, and we laugh because between her work and my work, we have way too many books. We have a whole wall full of books, and then we have boxes full of books, and a desk in our home with books piled on it. And what a privilege that is. Yet I brought a handful of these books just to demonstrate tangibly, hey, really, I'm not just talking. I'm not just talking out of nothing. There's some really interesting things. But Lisa Feldman Barrett, Harvard psychologist, researcher, has kind of really blown us all out of the water a bit with research on compassion. This is her latest book, How Emotions Are Made. I'm not sure I buy everything she says. Yeah, it's really interesting. This is Joan Halifax. I was just reading through some of this morning, and I think it's really critical to talk about what is compassion. Mindfulness training is really training awareness and compassion. It's training skills and awareness and compassion. And those skills and awareness and compassion are in fact the gateway to human performance optimization. Whether you're a police officer, a teacher, a pastor, whatever it is you do, awareness and compassion are the gateway, the optimization of your human experience. This is what I've come to believe in 15 years of research. Joan talks about compassion and empathy and being critically different. You know, helping professions, we have this notion of compassion fatigue, which means, oh, I've experienced too much compassion, now I'm fatigued. And Joan and other scholars are basically saying that's incorrect. Really what we're experiencing is empathy fatigue. And I think it's important to understand the difference between empathy and compassion. And in my operationalized view, empathy is being with another person who's suffering and seeing them. My conversation with them might be, oh, I feel what you're feeling. I see that you're suffering and I feel your suffering. That is empathy. Compassion, on the other hand, that is not sustainable, by the way. In that moment, it may very well be. But if I'm in the helping profession and I'm seeing one person after another person after the other person, that empathetic response is not sustainable. Compassion, on the other hand, is I see that you're suffering and I want to do something to help you. There's a boundary that keeps me from feeling that suffering. Right? Now, boundaries are great. Okay? Boundaries are great. But so the difference between compassion and empathy is really critically important. And when I train police officers, I tell them that compassion is fierce, it's kind, and it has boundaries. Okay? Because we as a society put police officers in a role. It's our job to hold boundaries. It's our job to hold boundaries. You all define boundaries. We call that law. Right? And there's politics associated with that too, and that's also how we define boundaries. But it's my job to enforce those boundaries, to hold those boundaries, right? And compassion is really, really critical. And here's some data around compassion, which is interesting, but not super helpful. At the end of the day, mindfulness training for first responders is about applied interpersonal neurobiology. Dan Siegel, psychiatrist, professor at UCLA, he's got a lot of books, but this is one that's a trip. I don't understand like maybe 10% of what he says, and I've actually read this. He coined the term along with some of his colleagues, interpersonal neurobiology, and it's taken all these disciplines together that really look at how the whole human machine functions. So what we're training with mindfulness, with skills and awareness and compassion, is really this simple, okay? We're teaching awareness of self and others, awareness of the world around us. We're growing our capacity for sense-making and decision-making. This is critically, critically important. We'll talk more about this as we move on. And also our capacity to cultivate greater wisdom and insight. So what exactly is mindfulness? At a courtesy to Jon Kabat-Zinn, I kind of default when I'm defining mindfulness to his definition. Jon Kabat-Zinn was a professor at University of Massachusetts Med School. He spent 30-some years there. We often refer to him as the father of secular mindfulness, although he doesn't like that term. And he built what we currently know as mindfulness-based stress reduction. He defines mindfulness very simply as this: awareness that emerges through paying attention on purpose, in the present moment, non-judgmentally, to the unfolding of experience moment by moment. And the key pieces about this, and I'll operationalize this a little bit. Basically, when I train mindfulness to cops, it's about being attentive to the world around you, taking in as much data as you possibly can with all of your senses. It's taking in data. That's being present, a little different way of framing it, without judgment. And it's the judgment that we fight. It's the judgment that I know your story because you're this person, right? And we have all kinds of labels to associate judgment to, all kinds of labels. And it's not allowing judgment to get in the way of your sense making and your decision making. And that's really, really difficult for us in law enforcement. And then also without the narrative, without the judgment drives narrative, right? So we come into a situation, we encounter a person, we immediately make a judgment about them, and then we start narrating our own story about things that are probably not even true. This is John's definition. I'm not sure I really like to define mindfulness so much anymore. People ask me frequently, you know, what does it mean? Well, it's about training yourself in awareness and compassion. So let's look at systems for a moment. So policing in America today, I think it's fair to say, well, it is fair to say, it's always fair, might not be correct, but it's fair to say that we have a number of crises in policing in America, one of which will become vividly clear to you as we move through our talk today. But our solutions are very insular, very, very insular. We think, we being the policing institution, think that we can solve our own problems, and that you all, as sort of the outsiders, really don't understand what our job's like, therefore, well, it's really nice to have an opinion, but your opinion isn't relevant. Okay, that's essentially our message to you all. We have this notion of this, I refer to this as the troubling trifecta. We try to fix things with technology. So we have a crisis in forced response in America, and one of our key ways of resolving it is with body cameras, body-worn cameras. Mm-hmm. Give it 10 years and we'll realize that is probably one of the single greatest mistakes we've made in law enforcement today. Mm-hmm. No, really, give it 10 years for many reasons, and some of which you probably wouldn't necessarily pick up on right away. Training. We put cops in a room and tell them not to be racist. We put cops in a room and tell them all about stress and how it's going to impact their lives and tell them don't drink alcohol. The divorce rate's really high, stay married. And we think that somehow it's gonna help, right? You know? I mean, it's asinine what we do, okay? And then traditional thinking. We are by nature a reactive system. We wait till problems emerge. A few weeks ago, I was asked to go down to Sacramento, California and visit with Assemblywoman Webb. And she's a politician. Represents a district in San Diego area. She's an African-American woman. She's a PhD in sociology. She's an activist, right? And I was cautioned by some of my colleagues, be careful, right? Be careful. It's a trap. And I thought, well, maybe it is. Maybe it is a trap. Mm-hmm. She's introduced legislation in the state of California that severely restricts forced response by police officers. It is not the right solution. However, what we're going to start seeing is because we can't fix ourselves, we're going to start seeing external influences attempting to fix us through legislation. And so this is what I mean about we're reactive. Instead of going and nurturing the appropriate relationships with our community and creating change internally so that we can fix some of these problems that we're seeing in America and policing, we basically tell you all, nah, you don't know. You don't know what it's like. This is complicated, you know, implying that you don't get complicated. And we're basically just continuing the status quo, continuing through doing the things we're doing. And then we all get in a room, we put smart people in a room, smart police leaders in a room, and we all sort of rally around each other and groupthink our way to status quo. But yet we think somehow it's innovative. We put lipstick on a pig and think it's innovative. And these are real issues. These are powerful, powerful forces in the system of policing in America that are getting in the way. And then when you have some weirdo from Oregon who comes in and says, well, you know, teaching meditation actually could improve force response. It could improve the ability of a white male cop to encounter a person of color in the community and actually have a positive encounter. But because we can't dive in beyond our own judgment around what that means, we can't get through it. We can't get through it to the actual science behind that and the practical value, even though we've demonstrated that all those things are true that I just said. So the system's a powerful force. And this photo, by the way, is a old 1969 Ford Fairlane police car in Chicago. And the message here is that we're frozen in time. It's a popular message when I talk to police chiefs. So this thing about mindfulness is that mindfulness gets us to this phenomenon, and that is neuroplasticity. How we think, our habits of thinking, deeply impact our habits of being, which deeply impact our habits of acting. And so to be able to impact at the root cause of action, habits of thinking, is a critical place to begin. And so this is where mindfulness brings us. We have the capacity to change our brain. Now, if you think about a culture that's burned out, think about a culture that has very limited capacity for compassion because of trauma, and we jump into that trauma and we start to find healing and train our way out of it with appropriate interventions. Mindfulness is just one. What we often find, by the way, with mindfulness training with first responders is that it opens up possibilities to allow us to make more informed decisions about how we care for ourselves. So what does that mean? That means that interventions like medical interventions. I'm shocked when I talk to police officers how few of them have an annual physical, how few of them get good data for their bodies. I'm not so shocked, but I'm constantly saying you should to police officers. This is the only time I say you should. I don't say you should meditate. Who the hell am I? I don't know. You should see a mental health therapist. You should have a mental health coach. And you shouldn't wait until you're post-trauma to do that, right? So medical intervention, psychotherapeutic intervention, tribal or social intervention is critical. We isolate ourselves. That's when really, really poor things happen, right? And then spiritual intervention, okay? I don't speak a whole lot about spiritual intervention. I don't even know what the hell that means. But I do know that there's communities of faith that are important that hold people up, and many first responders live in that world, and I think it's really important. And that's really our topic of discussion for tomorrow. What else do we know? You know, I could read these to you, but I really just want to show you data that really tells us, that demonstrates this. But let's talk first about some really sobering statistics. Yeah, that's cool. Everybody likes William James or whatever. Trauma. This is important. Police officers hold no monopoly on trauma. We are not special because we experience trauma. And I have to tell you this. How we speak, and now I'm speaking in this community, how we talk to police officers is really important. Because so frequently, when I talk to my combat veteran friends and someone says to them, thank you for your service, 9 out of 10 of my friends who've experienced combat have a visceral negative response to that, right? We mean well when we say that to them, but we don't understand that that's not helpful, okay? We talk to police officers, we frequently hear, oh, you have a really hard job. Oh, it must be really difficult. And I'll tell you what, you're creating greater distance between you and I when you say things like that, right? The words we use have power, and it's really important. I am not special. My trauma is not special. And I think if we can look at it, maybe with a little more scientific lens, we can remove some of the uncomfortable, God, I really don't know what to say to you, but I want to honor you, so I'm going to say something, and I hope it's not stupid. Well, it is. Okay, it is. But let's talk about one of my favorite psychiatrists, Bessel van der Kolk, and David's talked about him in his improv class, and there's a lot of connection between what David and I do, which is really amazing. He writes, we are fundamentally social creatures. This is really important. We're fundamentally social creatures. So what does that mean? Our brains are wired to foster working and playing together. The dysfunction occurs when we experience trauma. Okay, devastates the social engagement system and interferes with cooperation, nurturing, the ability to function as a productive member of the clan. I'm a trauma-impacted police officer who is not getting the appropriate interventions to mitigate my trauma. how effective do you think I am when I encounter you? It's not that I wake up and say, I'm an asshole today, I'm gonna go violate someone's civil rights and I really wanna punch somebody in the face. That may happen. There are antisocial people who are police officers, okay? Very, very rare. But if I wake up in the morning and I'm completely numb, right? I'm completely burned out, and I'll show you some data about medical stuff. My body is just sick, right? My heart is sick, my mind is sick. The result of my actions out in policing in the field are also going to be sick, okay? So this is really important for us to understand. Before we dive into the medical data around policing and landscape of suffering, let's talk about the data behind mindfulness and why it's so critical. This book, recent book, Altered Traits by Richie Davidson and Dan Bowman, remember I talked about him earlier, they published this last year. And both of these guys are giants in the mindfulness world. And Richie runs a lab at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And Dan does what Dan does. He writes books, and he actually does some work with Stanford, with the Compassion Institute there. Basically, these two guys got together and said, okay, we're tired of all this BS around research and mindfulness. We're tired of all these claims, the 7-Eleven Slurpee machine, you can drink all this and it's all good, don't worry about it. But we're also tired of criticism of the valid research around mindfulness. And so they looked at thousands of studies, some of which were their own, and they distilled them down to maybe a few hundred, and then distilled those down to, I don't know, maybe several dozen, looking at different research methodologies, and basically said, okay, this is what we know today is the most valid research around mindfulness, okay? And then they wrote this book, and they talked about that research, and they talked about the difference between a trait and a state. So for example, I could sit here and guide you through a 15-minute meditation, and we could do various studies, biometric and or self-reports, and we would find that 10 minutes after that 15-minute meditation, my guess would be most of you, 75% of you, would have measurable positive outcomes for that 15-minute meditation. That's what we call a state. So we've taken 15 minutes of meditation and we've moved into a state where we can measure positive outcomes. That will fade. We don't know when or how long. Some of you might take days, others it takes 7 or 8 minutes. We don't know, right? But it fades. It's not sustained because the practice isn't sustained. When we practice mindfulness over time, those states become traits. And a trait is just a consistent, measurable outcome of a particular practice, right? And so what we're striving for with mindfulness training is finding ways where it's sustainable, we can achieve traits, and if that makes sense at all, hopefully it does. But one of the things that, this is just one takeaway from the book, and the only one I'm gonna bore you with, that is critically, critically important for police officers. What they found was that there are 4 neural pathways that research clearly demonstrates meditation transforms. First one is responding to disturbing events. This is where resilience and recovery live. And this is essentially the description of the job of a police officer, responding to disturbing events. We can become more skilled at trauma. Sounds strange. And we add that with another researcher from Stanford, Kelly McGonigal, wrote a book a couple years ago called The Upside of Stress, has a wonderful TED Talk. I typically show it to most of my trainings, where she really talks about stress as just being stress. It's life. You know, stress and trauma, they're life, and actually, we can grow from them. What's really interesting, I'll query this audience, how many of you have heard about post-traumatic stress disorder? Okay, how many of you have heard of something called post-traumatic growth? Okay, the doctor, thank you. This is interesting, the point here is that we sort of get culturally fixated on the disorders. We get culturally fixated on, oh, post-PTSD, right? And PTSD is real. And as a first responder, I'm likely gonna walk through that valley at some point. I likely will, maybe it's a desert, I don't know, metaphorically, right? But I'm gonna experience that on some level, okay? The goal is, over time, I'm gonna come through that stronger than when I started. And that is a phenomenon that is post-traumatic growth. It doesn't just happen because we think it.
doesn't just happen because we wish it. It happens because we understand the science of trauma, and we have a plan of self-care, and we have a culture that supports it, we have a community that supports it, and we can achieve growth through trauma. Most of us in policing have no idea what post-traumatic growth is, because we join the business, and literally, this is how it works. You're a new cop, and what I can tell you now, imagine this. Imagine if any of you have relatives, young people who are joining policing, don't say this to them, okay? But statistically, it's a completely valid and reasonable thing to say. Welcome aboard, you've just given up 10 years of your life. And actually, it's on the low end. You've given up 10 years of your life just to be a cop. Another neuropathway, compassion and empathy. This is really critical, right? Because our ability, compassion is a skill. Empathy is a skill, right? It's not just a nice thing that we choose to do. It's a skill that we have to practice. And we have to safeguard that practice. Mindfulness is one pathway that helps us to do that. Attention. Really, meditation is all about attention training, which is why it's so damn annoying, right? Because what do? We focus on something and then, woo, here goes the attention, right? Here's the distraction, right? And by the way, that is the practice. That's why it's so damn annoying. Because it's focus of attention on my breath. Oh, I'm distracted by something. Oh, I better come back to my attention. Oh, I'm distracted. Whoa, you know, that's what it is. And it's not quieting, or it's not making thoughts go away. It's sitting with them and sitting inside the noise. But it's focusing on the signal in that noise rather than just having it be a chaotic. But attention practice is really critical, especially when we get to performance. And then our sense of self. This is really interesting. How many of you have an inner critic? Yeah. How many of you have an inner critic? Because just a real asshole. Yeah, right? Yeah. And you know, our brains are wired that way. Okay, so if you thought you were special because you have an inner critic, you're not. Our brains are wired. This default mode network is what some scientists refer to it, or the narrative network. We have an inner critic. And what we're doing with mindfulness is we're retraining the inner critic to become an inner coach. It doesn't mean it's all unicorns and rainbows, like Dan was saying earlier, but it does mean that instead of immediately being critical of myself, I can check that and go, okay, no, this is cool, I can do this, right? And it's reframing that sense of self, and that's really critically important. There's some other really interesting things around mindfulness that I'm not gonna share too much with you, because I wanna get some good data. We're gonna skip that one too. Okay. So, here's the world of police stress. This nice graphic, one of my colleagues at Pacific University put this particular graphic together. Really oversimplified, we have two different kinds of stressors. We have operational stressors. Those are the stressors out in the field, right? And we have administrative stressors. The shift work. Shift work alone has a really negative impact on the health and well-being of first responders. And all kinds of things going on. The administrative stressors, we might also call political stressors right now. You know, there's a lot of stress occurring in this business. And there's a little bit of data here. You know, generally what we're seeing is increase in mental illness and stress-related disorders, burnout, maladaptive coping. I'd like to say, although I'm not proud of it, but police officers are master maladapters. Okay? So I'll just be frank. Alcohol is a good old school way of coping. But you know, we have new things, well, not new things, but things we're getting better at today. Prescription meds. Medicating, right? Sex, violence. Nobody wants to talk about the violence piece. Those other three are like, oh, it wasn't bad enough as it is. But it just feels good to get in a fight, folks. Yeah, I said that out loud. And I know I'm gonna win. Even if I get my ass kicked, I'm still gonna win because there's a bunch of people coming to save me. That's a whole, I mean, it's hard. We don't know how to measure that. But sometimes, you know, it's worth saying to create some shock and awe. We see life quality, job performance, physical health, all of that, and I'll demonstrate what that looks like. But what's really interesting is this recent 2014 meta-analysis of health and wellness interventions in law enforcement in the United States. Okay? These researchers looked at what's going on nationally? What are we doing? And really what we found was what we're doing doesn't work. These are really smart researchers. Looked at interventions, wellness programs in policing in America, and essentially found, insufficient evidence exists to demonstrate the effectiveness. However, knowing this, police leaders in America still want to do the same kinds of things that we're doing. And we still see wellness as a luxury. Okay, let me tell you why it's not. Let me share some things with you. So, John Violante is an epidemiologist in Buffalo, New York. He's a former New York State police officer, and he's done amazing work. He spent the last 20 years researching mostly police officers, but sometimes fire service and medics. Recently published some data that suggests it's upwards to 15 years. But let's talk about some other data and why. So we have higher rates of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, alcohol use disorders, higher risk for developing diabetes, obesity, metabolic syndrome. It's better, trust me. Okay? And then just some applications here. Law enforcement officers who misuse alcohol, 4 times more likely to commit domestic violence. You know the thing about a fight, power and authority? Well, it goes home with us. Suicide. Okay? Every 17 hours, 3 to 4 times as many law enforcement officers are likely to die by suicide than in line of duty. Every year, you hear about the tragedy of officers dying in line of duty. There's more officers who kill themselves every year than die in line of duty. Now, I'm not sure I like that comparison, but it has some attention value to it. And John Violante says that, he says that on average, we experience 3 traumatic events for every 6 months of service. And that traumatic event is actually a pretty high bar. That's a pretty serious traumatic incident. The other interesting thing is, and this will maybe kind of sound counterintuitive when I'm going to share some more data with you, but on average, police officers have equal or greater resilience than the general population. But yet, our metrics don't suggest that. So this is really important. So Robert Cebulski is a researcher down at Stanford. He's done a lot of work. He wrote a really awesome book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, and it's about stress, okay? So he says, among many things, he says exposure to highly stressful events and traumatic situations over time can degrade cognition, memory, mental and physical health, and overall well-being. Just looking at that statement, looking at the role of the first responder, and more specifically the role of the police officer, you'd think that our training would be informed by this kind of science. And it's not. It's not informed by this kind of science. Post-traumatic stress disorder diagnoses increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, musculoskeletal problems, and cancer. Judith Anderson is a researcher in Toronto. She does some really good work around mindfulness, by the way. And I was at a conference not too long ago in January where she made the statement, I just love the statement. She said, you can't think yourself into resiliency. Yeah. And what does she mean by that? She means that we're training first responders in knowledge. We're putting them in a room and telling them,
you can't think yourself into resiliency.
Be resilient. It doesn't work. We have to teach them how to be resilient. What does that look like? So really, the picture I'm painting here is that our scorecard for our health and well-being is pretty poor. And if our scorecard for health and well-being is poor, that is our foundation for showing up in the world. That is our foundation for coming out in the world and performing the very complex job of policing.
Can I say something?
Question?
Just a comment. So one of the things that's interesting is you mentioned earlier just how this trauma is not different than our trauma, right? But I think as you present this data, it feels very different in some ways. So really is the point that when we try to separate the traumas, though, that it keeps us from joining together. Like, is that what you mean in the sense of, right? Because this is a traumatic landscape that does look different than many other professions and what many of us have experienced. But when we try to do our understanding of the other, then that has the potential to keep us disconnected instead of saying, yes, you've experienced a significant trauma. We could actually join in aspects of trauma instead of that separateness. Is that...
Yeah, it's really to prevent the othering, to prevent the, well, you're so different that I can't relate to you, I can't connect with you,
yeah.
Right? At the end of the day, I think in the human experience, trauma is one of those things that bonds us, right? Whether I'm talking to, you know, somebody from Rwanda, or, you know, a first responder who responded to the 9/11 towers who survived, right? I mean, it's, there's some bonding with that trauma. It's a different experience in context, but for sure. So John Violante has been tracking the Buffalo Police Department for nearly the last, well, I think nearly the last 20 years. And here's some of the data. This is just from Buffalo, but I suspect it's probably pretty close everywhere you go. 4 times more likely to suffer sleep deprivation than the general population. Okay. And what's interesting about sleep deprivation is that I think you all understand this intuitively, and some of you certainly professionally. But sleep deprivation is really, really dangerous. You know, if I'm sleep deprived as a police officer, it's kind of like it's like I'm impaired. Okay. And there's a researcher at Washington State University who is studying this. And he has some charts that basically says if you've got 5 hours of sleep for 2 or 3 consecutive nights, you're basically operating during your daytime at a 0.06 blood alcohol level, right? Imagine that. You have sleep-deprived first responders who are essentially cognitively impaired because of the sleep deprivation. That's pretty significant. We have among the poorest cardiovascular disease profiles in the occupation, and then obesity. 40% of police officers suffer from obesity. I actually think it's probably higher than that, just anecdotally. It's pretty common to see obesity, and it doesn't always look like obesity, by the way. You know, a body mass index of 30 or higher sometimes can be pretty deceptive. Prevalence of depression is nearly double that of the general population. This might not sound like a lot, but we're a pretty depressed population. And the fact that our rates are twice as high, nearly twice as high as in clinical depression is really interesting. I think a lot of that is undiagnosed in policing. And in conversation with John, one of the things he was telling me on a phone call not long ago was that he suspects that it's the inflammatory processes from all of these things happening that are really killing us. That, you know, and we're moving into epigenetics, you know, if our bodies are inflamed, our genes are going to start expressing diseases, maybe that otherwise would have taken years longer to do or not at all. Lots of things going on here. And these are just some of the data from the study in Buffalo. So the picture that I just painted for you is that cops are unhealthy. They're not well. And it's the profession that drives it. We take healthy people, put them in a job, and over the course of their career, watch their health and well-being erode. And the lucky ones thrive through their career, and the rest of us, the best we can hope to do is to survive. That's pretty much how it goes. So now let's talk about what does mindfulness training do for us in policing? So as I told you the story about taking the 8-week MBSR class with some of my colleagues, and what we did was we went over to Pacific University, where Mark's from, and met with their graduate school of psychology. And one of the professors, a guy named Mike Christopher, had been studying mindfulness in different contexts and had not done studies with policing. And I remember that my meditation teacher, Brian Rogers, who's there in Hillsborough, he had known Mike for a while, and we had some conversations with Mike, and Mike's one of his first responses was, I'm not going to teach cops how to meditate. Like, I'm not going to teach you how to be better at being impressive. And, you know, and Mike has since become a very good friend and a very good colleague, but we have to get through that, right? His perceptions of what this was about, and my perception is, oh, here's this dope-smoking hippie professor. I'm going to go to him. He's going to do research, seriously? You know? And so, but we joined together. We worked through our whatever perceptions, and we actually have grown to do some really cool things together. So let me talk about some of those cool things. So we just wrapped up a 2-year study funded by the National Institutes of Health. And that's critical because the U.S. Department of Justice has not, well, they just funded a study at University of Wisconsin, but in a decade of trying to get them to fund our work, they wouldn't do it because it's not, this isn't cool stuff, okay? And plus it pushes up back against the system, and DOJ is all about the system. But anyway, NIH funded. We took 60 police officers. We trained them in 8 weeks of mindfulness-based resilience training. Okay, I don't believe in stress reduction. Stress reduction is a fallacy. I believe in resilience. And what we found was that, and I'll show you some more data on this, but we found lower levels of alcohol use, aggression, burnout, something called experiential avoidance, and lower cortisol levels. Higher levels of mindfulness, but that's kind of boring.
Can you say what that experiential avoidance is?
Yeah, experiential avoidance is avoiding something that's uncomfortable. It's like, oh, David and I have conflict, and therefore I'm not going to go talk to David. I'm going to avoid the experience of talking with David. Right? And there's self-reported psychological measures that we use to get to that. But what we find with mindfulness training is I'm more likely to find my courage to go deal with that experience that I've been avoiding. It's kind of interesting.
Explain cortisol.
Cortisol is a stress hormone that lives in your body. And it's a very critical measure of your stress and health and well-being. And what we found, Violante's work in New York, he's found that police officers' cortisol levels are entirely dysregulated. Because what should happen, and I'll show you some data, we all wake up in the morning and our cortisol level rises, right? It's called awakening cortisol. And then it sort of levels off and stays where it needs to be. In police officers, we see a spike in that cortisol level and then a continued rise. And then all kinds of weird stuff happens with cortisol. But the thing about dysregulated levels of cortisol leads to disease.
Yeah.
It's really that simple. So this was a study we just finished. We did a pilot study in 2014 and found very similar results. Okay. And when I talk to community members, I mean, I'm hopeful that if I tell you that we can reduce anger and aggression, we can reduce alcohol use, we can improve compassion and empathy. I mean, I think the conversation's over. Right? But unfortunately, it's not, because somehow, even though there's good data that's, you know, comes from research with integrity, we still can't break through some of the barriers culturally in law enforcement to get to, oh yeah, we should probably train every cop in mindfulness, right? So what you see, the blue on this is the control group. We took 60 officers, we randomized each of them into two different groups, a control group, who basically had to get all the testing, and when everything was done, we eventually trained them. And then the orange is the folks who got the mindfulness-based resilience training. And so these are self-reported scales, but they're valid research. We found that we saw a significant decrease in aggression among our mindfulness-trained officers. We saw a significant decrease in burnout among our mindfulness-trained officers. Alcohol use, same thing. And interestingly, we saw a slight increase, although not statistically significant, increase in alcohol use by our weightless control group. I guess they were just waiting for the mindfulness turn. And sleep difficulties. So the other thing we can throw in there, I can reduce cortisol levels, anger, aggression, alcohol use, and improve sleep. Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to say we're done. Let's just do this. But it's not that simple. Mm-hmm. And then resilience measures increase, kind of a boring slide. This is one that's interesting. So the control group is in the blue, and the green line, if you can see that, is the mindfulness-trained police officers. This is cortisol. So this was a really difficult thing to capture. We took salivary cortisol. So we gave all these officers tubes to spit in, okay? And we said, when you wake up in the morning, spit in this tube. Don't drink anything, don't brush your teeth, spit in this tube. Wait 30 minutes, and spit in tube number two, and you're not done. Wait 15 minutes, and spit in tube number three. Really hard to do. We had to do some makeovers on some of these folks. But here's what we learned. We learned that the police officers who were in our control group who had not had mindfulness training was I don't know if I want to say dramatic, but a rise in cortisol that seemed steep. It seemed unusually steep. And then we didn't see it level off. We saw it still increase. And after 45 minutes, we don't know what happened, okay? Because we didn't measure that. With our mindfulness-based trained police officers, we saw a more stable level, a more stable growth, that slope of that line, and that growth is not as steep. And then we actually saw a decrease as it sort of stables out for the day.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Were they doing any meditation during
nothing formal. I mean, it's possible. Maybe Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, it's, and knowing the people only through it, I doubt it. Okay, so we published some papers. We just published a paper last month in the Journal of Psychiatry, which basically highlights all the data that I just showed you. There's really interesting papers that are coming from this research. Of course, none of them are there, but that's kind of boring now. There's more data to share with you, but I think we've hit enough of it. The bottom line is this, is that we built a training intervention that uses meditation that has some pretty significant outcomes. And the greatest barriers that we're finding are not with the individual police officers. Now, for sure, if I get a room of cops like this together, there's always five or six guys that are going to sit in the back of the room with their arms folded that literally look like they want to punch me in the throat. Okay? And then everybody else is some variation of that, to be honest with you, right? Because we're a terrible audience to train. But if I get enough time with those police officers, and maybe it's a day, maybe it's a little longer, generally can convince them by demonstration of these skills practices and some science that there's some merit to this, that this actually has some efficacy, that this is skills training that matters, that can literally transform how they show up in all of their life, okay? And back to this notion of human performance optimization, how you wake up in the morning is performance, right? How you encounter those first people in your tribe, right? Maybe that's your family. How you say good morning. How you order your coffee at Starbucks or Pete's or wherever it is that you order your coffee. Literally, like, what is the energy with which you're showing up to meet other people in the world, right? Are you attuned to how you're showing up? Are you attuned to the words you're using? Are you attuned to how you hold your body, right? Are you attuned to your facial expressions, right? What do we call this now? Resting unpleasant face, I'll just say, right? I mean, are you paying attention to that? And sometimes maybe it doesn't matter, but maybe it does sometimes. And if we're moving through the world unconsciously out of habit, disrupting those habits is key. And what mindfulness does for us is it helps us to disrupt those habits of thinking and those habits of being and those habits of acting. And in the context of law enforcement, this is critical. It gives us the skills to maintain compassion, to maintain awareness, and just to pay attention to the world around us. Now, tactically, it improves our capacity to take in data. It improves our ability to make sense of the data that we take in. And it improves our ability to make informed decisions. And so I'll frame that differently. If I, as a police officer, am in a situation, and I'm a practitioner of mindfulness, if I'm in a situation that is a rapidly evolving, dynamic, violent situation, I will be more skilled at responding to that violence. Now, what I won't do is I won't react out of the three most powerful destructive forces when unregulated: ego, fear, and anger. Those are not bad things. We're teaching with mindfulness how to be with ego, how to be with fear, how to be with anger. And in the context of policing, I know there's a whole lot of fear not slogans that have relevance in the spiritual world, but I'm telling you, fear is part of the job, folks. It is absolutely part of the job. And if my inner critic is going to start destroying me with thought because I'm experiencing fear in a tactical situation, then my performance is going to go to the shitter. Okay? So I really have to learn to be with fear and to welcome, oh, hello, fear. Literally say that to myself. Okay? And what, maybe it's fear today. Maybe it's judgment about someone else tomorrow. Maybe it's my discomfort with a certain person because of their gender identification that I don't understand. Right? Maybe it's discomfort because of their cultural background that I just don't understand. Right? And so being aware that, oh, that's emerging, that judgment's emerging, that fear, that anger, whatever it is, and just working with it and not allowing it to get in the way between me and the encounter of this person or this group of people. We see a lot of I believe we see a lot of fear-based force response because we're not teaching police officers how to be with fear, how to work with it, how to be aware that it's even there.
How to not be ashamed of it.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, culturally, that's a whole other thing. We shame ourselves, too. Mm-hmm. So I just pushed two sessions into one, and I skipped over some things because I wanted to have some time at the end, because I want you to experience what this whole meditation thing really is in the context of how I teach it, okay? And then I want to open up for any questions you might have. So what I'd like to do is just an extended invitation to do a short meditation practice. And hopefully that's not weird for all of you. Right? I sit in front of a group of cops and they're like, what? This is warrior skills training. Okay? And I showed that quote, and I'll go back to it, kind of finish with this quote here. I'll go back to it another time. Okay. There is a political argument around this term warrior, whether or not we can use it in policing. And I have held to, and I will continue to hold to, that there is a space in society for the warrior humanitarian. And that shows up in many places. It shows up in many professions, and it certainly shows up in the profession of policing. And police culture in America today is a popular culture. It is not an authentic warrior culture. And unfortunately, instead of shifting the culture, leadership in America, whether it's political or police leadership, which is often, well, it's always political, we want to rebrand the problem. Let's just call it something else. Instead of diving deeply into the infection of a misguided warrior culture in policing, we just want to rename it. So let's not call it a warrior anymore. It's your guardians. And it doesn't help the problem. It doesn't help the problem. Again, I think we have to dive into the root causes of the problem, and among the root causes is trauma and the subsequent health problems and the problems with the capacity for cognitive performance and compassion and all those things that show up in the field, right? But if we reverse engineer that, we get to the individual, but we also get to this tribe that is in need of deep reform. And that is policing in the need of deep reform. What that looks like, I'm not entirely sure. But I think it begins with training, but grounded in science, training skills and humanity for our police officers. There are forces that have moved us to where we are in police culture today, and these forces are primarily economic. You pick up a SWAT magazine, and they do exist, right? And you flip through it, what you're going to find are pictures of muscled, mirrored sunglass-wearing, badass warriors selling the gear, selling the weapon systems, selling the support systems, looking super cool doing it, right? Looking really cool, but it's not realistic, right? It's not realistic. And I think police leadership has fallen asleep in America, and we've allowed those economic forces to be our primary driver. Mm-hmm. And those economic forces are not only how advertising occurs, but it's also what we purchase. It's the gear we purchase, but it's also the training we purchase. And there's a whole lot of training out there that isn't helpful, but it's making some people a whole lot of money. And it sounds really cool. I'm gonna go to a bulletproof mind training and listen to, well, I'll throw this out there. This fella who I'm sure he's a fine human being on many levels, but in this level he's not, a guy named Dave Grossman. He's a retired lieutenant colonel, taught at West Point, so therefore he must be all that. And he travels the nation and the world giving this talk around warrior bravado. And it's not unrealistic. And it's actually quite alarming, okay? Because what he tells police officers is this. He tells police officers there's three kinds of people in the world. There's wolves. Those are the threats. Right? There's sheep, and that's all of you, by the way. And there's sheepdogs, and that's me. What a sad world when that's all there is. Right? And this is what we're teaching police officers today. And we're teaching them how to navigate that kind of culture, and it's destructive. It's absolutely destructive. So my message is counter popular culture. Now, I shared that quote with you from Richard Strozzi-Hepler. Richard is a somatic psychologist. He's going to do this old fashioned way. He's a somatic psychologist who lives in Petaluma, California. He's a Marine Corps veteran. He's an Aikido sensei. He travels all over the world doing conflict resolution. And I've had the privilege of training with him as his student. He wrote this shortly after 9/11. And Richard is a badass. He's a Marine, a Vietnam vet, Marine officer, been there, done that. He went into Fort Bragg, North Carolina in the 1980s as a contractor with the Department of Defense, and was on a team of sports psychologists who were the first to formally train mindfulness to Army Special Forces soldiers. And in that culture, it has stuck. One of the 27-year vet officers I trained down in California not long ago, his son's an Army Ranger. And he came up to me after 3 days of training. It's 3 days of intensive training. It's not easy training. And he says, you know, Rich, my son's been telling me, Dad, you gotta learn to meditate. This is super helpful. And I'm like, okay, my son's a Ranger, but what does he know, right? And he's like, this is 27 years, right? And he's like, I got 3 years left. These skills are gonna get me through that 3 years and get me to a place where I can retire and not be a statistic. Which this statistic is basically that you die shortly after you retire. 5-ish years. I don't think that's that accurate anymore. But so Richard writes, let awareness be your weapon. Be there for those who have suffered more than we. And he's been heavily influential on how I train. This is the authentic warrior ethos right here. This is it. This is a man who still to this day, in fact, I think I was there for 1 week, and this nondescript rental car comes rolling in, actually a couple of them, and these dudes step out of the car. And I don't know if you've had exposure to military special operations, but, you know, these people, and they're not all men anymore, they get out of the car, and you're like, okay, I'm in the presence of some badass people here, right? And they still come to him to train. And it's not their typical training, right? But there's a place for this authentic culture, and I think if we can use things like mindfulness to bring us back to this authentic culture of being a warrior humanitarian, we'll go a long way to reforming policing America. Okay, so the invitation is to comfortably, whatever that means, and with your eyes closed, just take a few deep breaths in and out. Maybe breathing in through your nose, out through your mouth. And when you're ready, just allow your breathing to find its natural rhythm. And let's take a moment just to physically feel our body. Maybe noticing our posture, noticing how we're seated, feeling how our body is making contact with the chair or the floor. Maybe just doing our best to sink a little bit deeper into this posture, a little bit deeper into this force of gravity. It's constantly pulling us towards the center of the earth. And the idea here is just to create a nice solid foundation of grounding with our body. And recalling that part of the practice of mindfulness is non-judgment. Maybe said differently, an open curiosity. And let's see if we can bring that open curiosity without looking for anything in particular and without trying to fix anything we find. Bringing that open curiosity to our emotional weather. And just simply noticing as an observer what might be there, if anything. And now bringing that same open curiosity, that same non-judgment, that same observer lens. Let's bring our attention to our thought stream and simply noticing what's there. Maybe paying attention to the speed of our thoughts, the volume of our thoughts, without getting tangled up in any particular thought. It might be helpful now and again to take a nice deep breath. The invitation now is just to take a few deep and slow in-breaths and out-breaths. Allowing your breathing to find its natural rhythm. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes and we'll finish our practice. And it's just a very simple three-centered check-in. Meditation practices that we train with police officers are quite a bit longer, but that's just a sense of what's there. There's some really great meditation practices that involve emotion and compassion practices and attention practices that we dive into that all have proven very helpful. So, questions, comments? Up front here.
In your studies that you did, were you working only with male officers or were there any female?
No, both, yeah. Both male and female.
Did you find the differences?
No difference. Yeah. In the back, sir.
Similar.
Go ahead, sorry. I really hate to bring this up. But how does it, I see the validity, I see the studies, and it makes really good sense, and I just intuitively know that this is what we should do. We've got to, calm the inner being, I believe in this totally. However, we've got an administration that thrives on chaos and anger and fear, and how do you work in the face of that? That resistance.
Yeah, so great question. So looking at the national political landscape, the leadership in Washington, right. I'm assuming that's what you're referring
Absolutely.
To. You know, here's what I found is that change is not going to happen from Washington. Okay? It's just simply not. It's going to happen with you. It's going to happen in small places. And I got to tell you, Pacific University, Mark, forgive me, is a small university. And they've become the epicenter of this research. And now we have giants like University of Wisconsin, Madison, which are emerging, and we help them emerge, so it's our fault. I think that change happens organically, okay? And let's say even if we had a president who didn't thrive on chaos, and was really interested in social justice, I think still U.S. Department of Justice would mess this up. Because they want something that's a cookie cutter. They want something that is, give me the 4 hours of training I can push out to every police officer in America and we will, woo, congratulate ourselves. Look at us, we're awesome. It will not work. I would even submit that the mindfulness training that I do in Portland, Oregon, looks different than the training that I do in Phoenix, Arizona. Okay, it has to, because there's so many nuances, so many complexities to community and culture and situations that emerge. So on one hand, I'm not discouraged by the chaos in Washington, and I'm very encouraged by what I've seen. And keep in mind, I've been doing this for 15 years, which on some level is a long time, and on another level it's just a flash, right? But this movement started in Hillsboro, Oregon, because some of us were determined to light this firecracker. And even if I stop doing this work today, it's still going. It's still going to continue because it's infected other grassroots communities who are like, we need to do something more. And the truth is, we need to look at the science and how do we operationalize that science to produce outcomes that are helpful for the individual officer, but also for the community, right? Because, I'll tell you, I started this journey out, I didn't really care about the wellness of the cop. I was like, I'm mildly interested in health and well-being. But what I figured out was, well, wait a minute, that's a critical component, right? And there's a lot of interest in Washington around health and well-being, but we're interested in sit-ups and push-ups. And that's what they're gonna continue being interested in, and that's the training they're gonna continue to push, and I'm not worried about that, because the people are more powerful than the beltway. And I don't think I'm delusional. Sir?
Back to the statistics, I assume it's all just American police officers that were studied in those.
Our research was only American officers.
Yeah.
There's been some research in Toronto with Canadian officers. and in other parts of BC, I'm not sure exactly where, Australia, the UK.
How do they compare?
I don't know. Well, see, nobody has done the training we've done, so it's all just emerging. I don't know what, Australia has done some study with police recruits and found some interesting data that's similar to ours, but the other nations are just beginning. In fact, I get to go to Canada here to go do some training. One second, in the back.
Yeah, I was wondering if this, if there were plans for this research to be extended to the effects of police behavior and interactions with community members. Because you talked about how some of these effects that have been studied might change those interactions, but are you going to study those as well?
Yeah, so really great question. So the question is, will the research continue and look at police officer behavior? And the answer is yes. So what's interesting is this NIH-funded grant is a community violence reduction grant, right? And so really what we're looking at is, can we reduce violence on the part of the police officer? And we're very subtle about that, okay? Because we couldn't go to police chiefs and say, hey, we're doing a study on police officer violence, we want you to join us. we went to them and very slyly said, hey, we're doing this study on mindfulness and we want to reduce anger and aggression, will you join us? And they're like, yeah, we'll do that, right? So we actually have, I'm hopeful this week, we get news that we're funded for another study, a much bigger study with Portland Police Bureau in Albuquerque, New Mexico, looking at that very thing. The difficulty is what you measure. So the measures of police officer behavior are very, very difficult to look at. We can certainly look at force response, but strangely enough, force response is not a good measure. It's just, it's too variable. There's other measures we can look at. Say again?
What is force response?
Me pulling out sticks and beating you. Yeah, I'm sorry to be that crude, but yeah, it's police officers using force against another person, right? That's a component. Citizen complaints are a component. Outcomes are a component. There's lots of ways to look at that, but it's tricky. We actually had conversations with Portland Police Bureau leadership around what can we measure? What data can we get to that we could measure? And some of that they carefully guard, you know. So, one second, in the back, we had a question.
Yes, it's a practical question. Maybe others understood it and I didn't, but when you were talking about it's not being helpful to thank our servicemen or our police officers, why not, and what would be helpful if we were at Starbucks or something and we had a conversation, or why is it not helpful?
Well, that's like a conversation over beer. I'm not sure I'm saying don't thank the police officer. I did say that many of my friends who are veterans, combat military veterans, do not like to hear thank you for your service. They just don't like to hear that. Now, when it comes to the police officers, how we speak to them. I think I hear frequently, oh, I know what your job's like. Mm. I know this is really hard for you. And I think to myself, well, come work the night watch with me. I mean, come do a death notification with me. Right? I mean, come respond to a SID's death with me. And then the best response sometimes is saying nothing. Now, you can still find a way to connect, but I think all I'm saying is that be aware of the words you use, right? And sometimes thank you for your service feels trite. It feels superficial. And I know it's well-intended, but it's also sometimes in the right context even condescending.
Well, and can I offer, I think that one of the things, still having worked with law enforcement, but on the therapy side and as a clinician, is having conversation. So again, trying to eliminate just this otherness about them, and instead joining as if you're standing in line at the Starbucks, like, how's your day going? And like you would anyone else. And so that creates that sense of community and removes aspects of that otherness, because that's not always helpful. So, and sometimes from that conversation, they'll be like, thank you. Thanks for doing the work that you do. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is always well received, but it's because it's from that place of joining. And, you know,
yeah.
I think when your intentions
there,
it's pretty cool.
There's a question over here.
I was wondering if individuals come and approach you, or does it have to go through the whole squad or whatever it is committed to doing? I mean, the individuals that say, hey, I'm here and this works. How do I learn to practice mindfulness? Can an individual police officer?
Oh yeah. I mean, I talk to cops all the time, and that's why I have a website and I refer people to different resources. And, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yes?
I'm wondering, because you are making 1,000 quick decisions every day, and I understand the outcomes, you know, maybe later in terms of health and habitual kinds of things, but how does mindfulness help you find confrontation in a terrible situation?
Yeah, okay, so do me a favor. Everyone, close your eyes for me. And I'm going to ask you a question. With your eyes closed, what do you see? What data can your brain receive from your senses with your eyes closed? And how frequently do you rely on your field of vision for your sense of sight? What do you hear? What do you feel? What do you notice? Mindfulness skills for police officers, for all of us, have tactical application. They teach us to become more skilled at taking in data. So when I respond to a radio call, and you can all open your eyes now, when I respond to a radio call, my training in mindfulness allows me to see what's there rather than to see what I expect is there. Right? That's just one thing. It allows me to take in more data, to understand my own bullshit getting in the way of how I make sense of that data. Right? And therefore, I have a greater ability to make more informed decisions. We know we have greater access to working memory with mindfulness practice. We have greater cognitive agility. We have greater emotion regulation. So just those things translate to a greater tactical performance, better decision making. Mm-hmm. If I have to fight you, I will fight you better. I will be faster, more skillful, and it will be for the right reasons rather than because I'm angry at you. Mm-hmm. Right? So there is absolutely a tactical advantage to training this stuff. And this is just the fact that we're reducing cortisol levels, the fact that we're improving health and well-being, create a greater foundation for me to go and perform.
It gets back to the idea of neuroplasticity that you talked about. So that in mindfulness, you're developing like this internal architecture that starts to be used so that when you're in the line of duty, it's already there, right? And you have right. that ability for flexible Absolutely. Response.
Yeah. We're not, you know, there's a lot of conversations around, oh, just pause, right? That's, I just don't like to hear that. Mindfulness is not about pausing. It's about creating habits of thinking and being and doing that show up everywhere we go and make us more skilled in whatever arena we're in. Whether it's working with family, working with friends, at work, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It really is this, in the skill set of policing, this is, I train compassionate badasses. And I use that term when I train cops. Right? And what are we called to do? We're called to be a compassionate badass, which means show up to whatever's there and skillfully pay attention, take in data, make sense of it, and make good decisions with compassion. And again, compassion, fierce, kind, with boundaries. And I would submit to you that if I have to use force on another human being, it is a compassionate act. Yes, sir.
One more thing. With the fact that people have the cell phone ways to do the video, and you see on the nightly news, and I understand the idea that this is the news crew has to, you know, make the television, you know, audience tune in to see but you often you see a police officer in a situation where it's pretty obvious looking at the thing. There's a guy crawling on his hands and knees towards the officer, saying, don't shoot, and the officer unloads a clip into that person. And it's not just a rare thing, you see it several times a month, and maybe a week. So what can you do to, it seems like, What I see is a person that approaches the car and expects the worst and starts shooting almost that's the first thing he thinks about. And I know that's not correct, but that's the image that comes across.
Yeah, my friends in the Marine Corps say expect the best, prepare for the worst. And in policing, we tend to expect the worst and prepare for the worst, you know? And maybe that's just a mindset. It's a great question that segues us into tomorrow, okay? So tomorrow's session, I'll share with you some of the obstacles, some of the barriers, some of the politics, some of the really interesting challenges I've had in the last decade or so bringing mindfulness to law enforcement. And then we'll dive into, in the organic level, the grassroots level, what can we do? But at the end of the day, we're having this conversation because of those videos. Because those videos are demonstrative of the condition of policing in America today. And then if we look at what is the leadership's response, right? What is the community's response? And what kind of dissidence do we have there? And really what we're talking about is how do we shore up that dissidence and really look at what works, right? What works to prevent two Sacramento police officers from really just being afraid, coming around a corner, seeing a black man and shooting him multiple times, right? How do we prevent that,
right?
And we don't prevent that by putting him in a room telling him not to shoot people, which is what we do in America today in policing. We do prevent that by investing in evidence-based training, which is outside our comfort zone, and it's called mindfulness. Thank you all so much. Appreciate it.